thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 47 for the 12th of November, 2009. Publishers Bleakley. I'm Dan Cohen. It's time for another Digital Campus podcast. We're back once again from the lovely campus of George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. And here, of course, with our regulars, Tom Scheinfeld and Mills Kelly. Hi, Mills.
Hey, Dan.
Welcome back, and we are adding another two great irregulars, as we've been calling them, people that we have been meaning to have on the podcast for a long time on a semi or regular basis, and who we think will add a lot to our discussion here because they are smart and knowledgeable and in interesting positions, and we hope our audience agrees with us on that. And today we're adding two more. First of all, someone who used to work here at the Center for History and New Media at George Mason, Josh Greenberg. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Dan. Glad to be here.
Yeah, welcome to the podcast. Josh is the Director of Digital Strategy and Scholarship at the New York Public Library and is one of many. Wait, I think there are three of us on this podcast who started their careers as Associate Director of the ECHO Project. Is that right, Josh?
Yes, I guess I was the third.
You can go to echo.gmu.edu to know what we're talking about. But the center has a longstanding project on the history of science and technology that Josh and Tom and I all worked on. And it's sort of a joke around here that the new person in town always takes the position of Associate Director of ECHO, even though the project is now a sort of legacy project. We're still running it, but we're not adding a lot to it at this point. So it's great to have Josh back on the podcast. And Josh, you'll be glad to know that I'm still receiving mailings relating to ECHO, including invitations to the annual meeting of the Artificial Limbs and Organs Organization that I think we did an ECHO project on.
We did.
Yes, and I was showing that to Tom the other day, that there is actually this year's annual meeting, which is in Baltimore in May, there is Renal Gland Day. So if you're interested, I'll forward you that invitation.
I'm so going.
Also, we'd like to welcome to the podcast from the Chronicle of Higher Education, a staff writer there, Jennifer Howard. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Dan.
It's great to have you on the podcast, and you have written for, among other places, let's see, you were at the New York Review of Books, and you've also written for Boston Review, Wilson Quarterly, and the Washington Post. You were a book reviewer or editor at the Washington Post, is that right?
Because I feel like contributing editor, yeah.
Right, I feel like I've read your byline in the Post on some book reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And what's your beat at the Chronicle?
Well, it's been redefined a number of times. They keep adding things. I began as the humanities reporter when we had a research section, and I've been redefined as scholarly communication, which includes not only humanities, but publishing, archives, libraries, and basically all that stuff bundled in together. So it's an active beat.
That's great. Well, I think we'd like to start with part of your beat, and you were at the meeting of the Association of Research Libraries, which is a group of about 200, is that right, of the largest research libraries in the United States, I believe, right? Or is it international?
It's mostly United States. I think they have a couple of Canadian members. But it's about 150, something like that.
Right. And Josh, you were at this meeting as well, is that right?
I was. I actually gave a talk on the last day.
That's great. Well, two stories really caught our eye from coverage of this. And maybe Jennifer and Josh, you could, as the new people on the block, you could help us out a little bit to explain it. First of all, Josh, you were on this panel on special collections, and it's not something we've talked a lot about on the podcast. So we thought it'd be nice to start there. you know, you do a lot of work at the New York Public Library with getting special collections, that is, unique documents that are only at New York Public Library online. And can you tell us a little bit about what you spoke about and where you see special collections going in a digital age?
Sure, absolutely. I guess the main argument of both my panel and, in fact, a day-long stream that was co-hosted by ARL and the Coalition for Networked Information was really that that we haven't talked enough about special collections in the digital age. In some ways, and partly this is because of Google and others, what you could sort of think of is as mainstream books have kind of sucked all the oxygen out of the room over the past maybe 2 years. And
we've certainly been obsessing about them here on the podcast.
We have been too, in, at NYPL and everywhere else. So I guess my basic argument was in fact that if you project ahead, and I tried to be a little controversial in the way that I framed it, increasingly I've sort of started calling pretty much the swath of material that Google and frankly the Internet Archive and others have been focused on digitizing, including all the focus on orphan works and out of print, you know, 20th century works, really calling those what I see as commodity books. One way or another, I can't see a world 10 years down the road, even 5 years down the road, where one way or another, scholars, researchers, students get access to those books, but they don't really care where they come from at all. That role of the library as a very visible part of the chain that gets a book in the hands of a reader is increasingly going to be effaced by, you know, either one or a handful of platforms, whether it's Google or HathiTrust or the Internet Archive. And so the basic question I think that raises for libraries, both, you know, traditional academic libraries and, frankly, you know, libraries like mine that have a somewhat more independent role, is, okay, what's our identity? Where do we stake our ground, and how do we offer value if it's not simply the act of putting books in people's hands?
Right. Now, and you're a pretty well-funded library among libraries, and certainly among public libraries. I would assume this problem is even more acute among the small collections that really don't have the funds to kind of get their stuff online.
I think it is, although if you, I would say don't quote me on this, but I'm on a podcast, so I guess quote me on it.
We'll have our sound manager just put in a very long beep starting now. Go ahead.
I mean, I think my sense is that in terms of the collections budgets and sort of proportion, I mean, we spend a huge amount, frankly, like most academic libraries, on secondary literature, on serial literature, on increasingly what look like, you know, whether we're buying or licensing in the digital realm, access to that material. So we are, you know, we do have, relatively speaking, a substantially larger amount of rare, unique archival materials, which gives us a great opportunity to start figuring out how do we best position these materials for research. But and how do we create an identity for the library that derives from those strengths? But all things considered, you know, we're still scraping by like everybody else.
Jennifer, you were at this meeting. What was your sense? I mean, are these libraries scared, or what's the general sentiment in this environment? Where, as Josh said, it feels like there's some big companies or big organizations like the Internet Archive or HathiTrust, which is the a kind of alliance of a dozen universities that are putting all their digital assets in one place. What is the prevailing sentiment in this group about, you know, what to do next?
But it's interesting. I mean, it's, you know, these are tough times for everybody. It's not news. Budgets are being slashed everywhere, including many library budgets. So you'd think that they would be really feeling on the ropes, and while they're very conscious of the stresses and strains, a number of them are looking at this as a great time to put make some changes that have been a long time, not even that long coming, that you can use tightening budgets as a way to really accelerate some of these transitions away from duplicate print copies, for example, to more of an online environment. There's a lot of interest in collaborations across institutions, among institutions, not just the traditional library buying consortia, but more radical partnerships. And I think librarians continue to be very interested in finding ways to transform what they do and positioning themselves as facilitators in this new digital age that we're all trying to find our way in. They're not just gatekeepers of information. They are publishing consultants now, or even active publishers. More and more that's becoming the case. they're really seeing it a role for themselves as a go-to resource for faculty who are trying to navigate copyright and open access and all these things that get thrown at researchers, some of whom are very savvy about them and some of whom are not and just kind of don't want to be bothered, just want to figure out how to get their stuff out there to the best venues. So it's when I talk to them, I sense a lot of energy and it's kind of a determination to push forward and make something good of this. That came through very clearly at the ARL meeting, particularly with this focus on special collections, which they see as something that makes, nobody else has your special collection. It's called a special collection for a reason. So you can look at that as a way to make your brand more visible to your administrators. You can use it as a pedagogical tool. There's a lot of interest in working with faculty to get students hands-on with this material. It's really an interesting time. I think librarians are seeing some opportunities here.
And the other thing that I would just add in terms of the special collections is there's a huge opportunity for institutions that have rare, unique archival materials, whether sort of on the scale of the New York Public Library or a small local historical society, in the sort of digitally networked context, all of a sudden you've got this potential audience. And one of the things that we know is communities of enthusiasm, communities of interest, communities that don't traditionally map onto the professional category of scholar or student may well be out there and interested in the kinds of things that you've got real strengths in.
Right. So let me throw out a complicating piece to this, because I'm completely sympathetic to everything that's been said so far, but I don't know if it's chairing or refereeing might be the right way to put it, an unconference session at the Slavic Studies Conference later this week that is devoted to what's happened to the Slavic and Baltic collection staff and reading room at the New York Public Library. And lots of people are all in a dither because that room has been closed and the staff has been downsized to one person. And some of that is just anxiety about this transition from kind of bricks and mortar library to digital library, digital special collections. But some of it is, I think, also about the loss of kind of expert consultation in the library itself. And that, it used to be that, and the same sort of thing happened with the European Reading Room at the Library of Congress a couple of years ago, which vanished temporarily to make way for Abraham Lincoln. And lots of people around here got very, very upset about that because all of a sudden they couldn't access that specialized assistance. This is, I think, going to be one of the real challenges for libraries as they shift to becoming, providers of content to the world as opposed to providers of content to a local constituency and also have some expert staff members who can help people navigate that. How do you think that's going to play out?
Well, with regard to even the specific case of the Slavic and Baltic division, I think it's an example of what I see as a broader theme that particularly among research communities, specific libraries have been sort of, community spaces and are really identified as places for, even if you only have a couple researchers in there at a time, places that are real spaces that are at the heart of a professional community. And I think you're absolutely right to put your finger on the sort of professional consultation and the services there, because I think up until now, well, really still now, I think the library world is still teasing apart the question of how tightly bound, spaces that were originally places to house books and places to work with books. If you start to rethink at a basic level where you're storing those books and how you're using your physical space, I think libraries are working through right now, what does that mean to those spaces and the services and the sort of community focus and the community facilitation that a library, that sort of space that was traditionally about housing those books, what happens to that space? I'd argue that that's actually a core role for the library going forward. We don't have really good models within the library world of what it looks like to facilitate a core community that comes to you because you've got the stuff they're interested in, what it looks like to facilitate them if you're not talking about a special collection reading room. But I know we're we're actively exploring different models for that, and I think a lot of others are as well.
Well, and I think that, one of the models for that is the sort of tech support forums that abound on the internet. I mean, I was amazed when I got my first Mac laptop and had some problem with it. And I posted something on one of the forums and had three answers in about 10 minutes from who knows who those people were, providing me with their expert knowledge that on how to fix something in my computer. Well, I think that, you know, too often library users have become dependent on those two or three librarians in that physical space. And so when those people aren't there anymore, then, oh my God, what are we going to do? We can't use the collection anymore, or I can't send newbie grad students there because they won't have anybody to help them. When, as Josh said, I think the sort of facilitating of community is going to be really important.
Right. And if I can give you one tangible example of that. So in about probably about 3 weeks to a month, we're going to announce the public preview of a new website for the New York Public Library. It's been in the works for about a year and a half. And actually, at the core of it is a sort of repositioning of the libraries of NYPL.org and everything the library does online from a single monolithic institutional voice to really foregrounding every individual librarian and curator and their expertise, and giving them a set of tools that let them, I mean, at a basic level, publish information and their knowledge out to the world, but also begin to engage in that dialogue. So it's really an experiment. But what we're hoping to see is that individual staff, individual curators, just people across the library who have core expertise, whether it's in a local geographic community or a sort of topical research community, can start use the library as a sort of place to plant their feet and speak out to that community that they serve.
I've certainly heard a lot of anxiety about them, about what happens to reference specialists, as you know, if you have to cut your budget. Do you decide not to upgrade your equipment for 2 years, or do you ask a special collections person, or what do you do? You know, there's certainly some anxiety about that kind of expertise drying up and vanishing. On the other hand, you know, with this kind of discovery environment we've got, people are finding information through different media anyway, not necessarily going to the library, and the librarians have to figure out how they can kind of remind users that they're there to help guide them and figure out new roles for themselves, not just knowing, you know, these deep collections, but figuring out all these copyright intellectual property access issues.
I was going to ask about that, Jennifer. I mean, you wrote this really interesting article in the Chronicle about a further complicating factor, which is this push toward open access, which again makes, you know, the library sort of more permeable and maybe less unique. If access is available widely, you don't need to go to a location to get a document. Can you talk a little bit more about that and where you see scholarly communications going if, you know, you don't actually have to go to the library to get access to a particular collection or gated resource that's online?
Well, this is something I think librarians are seeing as a big opportunity for them. I mean, they have an economic reason, of course, to support open access. They don't want to pay these exorbitantly high journal subscription rates if they don't have to. They don't want to shell out for big database subscriptions if they can get these things other ways. So I think they see it as a way to make themselves more relevant, in part because they're the people that a lot of faculty now go to if the faculty want to do something like put research in a repository. That's, you often do that, you know, with help from the librarians. So they're really, as a community, the research librarians are very interested in promoting open access and public access, and I think they see that as, you know, it would be going too far to say they want to put the publishers out of business, but they really are, I think, see themselves as stepping into that role.
Huh. And Josh, I mean, I guess from your perspective, I mean, the open access thing cuts both ways, right? I mean, there is the budget element to it, but there's also, I would assume, often the question of whether to make your own stuff open access, right? And also the intellectual property around a lot of the materials you have and what to do about that. Can you give us a little insight? I know some things are a little touchy to discuss, given I assume you're bored, but what are these discussions like inside of a library like yours?
Well, I mean, you know, candidly, I think a lot of it comes down to the extent to which I keep coming back to the identity of the library is bound up with physical possession and that gatekeeping role to physical collections. One of the things that I feel like I hear all the time in discussions of things like this is possessives, you know, they're our collections. This, you know, there's a lot of talk like that. You know, open access on one hand, you know, getting a digital copy of everything within a library and getting it out into the world in as open and free a license as possible. There's one way in which that would allow sort of libraries with their traditional mission of you know, facilitating access to knowledge to sort of declare victory and move on. The question is, what do they move on to? And I feel like there's still a lot of clinging to that possession. Now, a piece of that, honestly, is about revenues. There's been a lot of work done about, particularly even in the museum world, where museums have been very loath to put images from their collections up online in high resolution versions, because there's a business model that they charge for if it's a public domain image, they can't charge for access, but they basically enclose that image in essentially a contract that a user has to agree to, which effectively cuts off fair use of those images, or regardless of fair use, if it's public domain, any kind of use. So in order to get your hands on an image from, say, certain parts of the Smithsonian, you've traditionally had to agree that you wouldn't make money off it, and that you would, in fact, go back to them and pay them if you were going to make money off of that image. I've heard arguments that when it comes right down to it, if you analyze that, you're pretty much chasing nickels and dimes, and that relatively speaking, institutions aren't making a lot of money from this. But it's, you know, particularly at this economic moment, that's been a hard argument to push.
Well, maybe we could move here from the collection holders to the people who make the content for those collections, the publishers. And it seems like there's a lot of activity going on here as well. Jennifer, you've been covering this. What do you see as some of the interesting changes that are going on in academic publishing that relate to these issues of the digital realm and also obviously changes in cost structure?
Well, it's a challenging time to be at a university press. I think that would be putting it mildly. But as with the libraries, there's a lot of interest in figuring out some solutions that might move us all forward and keep us all in business, however we're defining business. I've been particularly interested. There's a group of university presses that are getting together to look at possible ebook platforms that they could share. It's Temple, NYU, and Rutgers are the three who are doing this first investigation. And the idea is to come up with see if there's a shared platform that they could all mid-sized presses could in theory use to make e-monographs, get them to libraries, and kind of streamline this portion of their business. They know they need to go digital. A lot of them are very interested in doing it. They just can't figure out how, a lot of them. And this kind of approach may be very helpful. Certainly seems to be something that librarians would look at with great interest. So that project is in the very early stages, but I'd be curious to see how far they get with it. And I know there are other discussions going on in the university press world about ways to collaborate on getting monographs into digital form and out to libraries. So that's one thing to keep an eye on. Open access, you know, continues to be difficult. I think like libraries, presses, you know, they want to disseminate information. They just have to find some way to stay in business doing it. A lot of them are actually working with their libraries now, getting absorbed by the library or just entering into a partnership, trying to look at publishing not as university press publishing but as university-based publishing, which can be anything from, you know, conference papers that come out of the department to a monograph. The Ithaca report that came out on university-based publishing still has a lot of traction in these discussions. And people are trying to see if they can work with that model so that it's not presses siloed here and libraries siloed there, but everybody with, you know, many tiers of publishing activity are working together. I'm glad I'm not running a university press right now, I have to tell you.
Something we've talked a lot about on the podcast is presses, you know, nearly going out of business or folding themselves into other organizations. Is this just the end of the for-profit, if they ever were for-profit, for small-profit academic press? Is this just the end of the line?
Oh boy, that's a tough one. Put me on the spot. I don't think so. I don't think university presses are dead. by any means, or even as much at death's doors are sometimes made out to be. As far as business model, though, I don't know. You know, it does seem to make a lot of sense, especially for the smaller ones, to become an academic department or to enter into some kind of collaboration with a library where they don't have to do the same kinds of bookkeeping that they would if they're independent, more or less independent institutions or entities. You know, everything's being redefined, and presses are being redefined more than most things, I think.
Yeah, I wonder if there's an analogy to be made to newspapers and the newspaper publishing business, where, you know, I don't think, you know, all newspapers are going away. It would be hard to imagine a world without the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, but many of the smaller ones are sort of going away, or they're being gobbled up by the bigger ones, and that there will be fewer in the future newspapers. I wonder if we might. Might be seeing something similar, and you know, you hate to say it, but some of the smaller presses going away, and some of the larger ones remaining, or ending up with some consortia of the kind Jennifer was describing. I think we may see some of that. I don't know if this is the case, but I think looking at what has happened and what is happening and what will happen in the newspaper world is probably, for people who are looking to predict the future, probably a good place to start.
See, I think the newspaper model is a really good one for comparison, but I think it's really not the smallest presses that are going to go under, because the smallest newspapers have not gone under either. You know, they survive because they have a really local constituency that, you know, they want to find out who won the high school football game last Friday and that kind of thing. It's the mid-sized presses that are going to go under, the ones that wish they were a big-time university press, and they can't sustain that, and so the small ones, which are essentially kind of vanity operations or very very, very specific to a particular topic, those are going to survive because they have constituencies, or the university just likes to say they have a press and so is willing to publish two or three books a year so they can do that. And then the big ones, you know, the Princetons, the Chicagos, the Californias, those will all survive because for a long time, I think.
Well, but here's one question that I have. One of the other trends that's emerging among research libraries right now is, under a lot of economic pressure, the desire to dedupe, to say, hey, you know, why do we both need to be buying the same book if there's a good interlibrary loan system, and frankly, only one scholar a year across both our campuses is going to want to touch that book? Why don't we enter into more, even more collaborative collection development efforts than before? We recently saw an announcement from Columbia and Cornell that their university libraries are gonna take this notion of coordination and collection development and other areas to an entirely new level. Now, one of the things that means is, if you assume that there's always been a foundation level of purchases, that there are, you know, however many, you know, couple hundred research libraries around the world that can be counted on to reliably buy a copy of, you know, any book that gets turned out, what happens when they start coordinating and consolidating their efforts, and, you know, maybe that couple hundred reliable purchases pairs back to, you know, 50, even 25?
Well, I mean, it may not. I think it's very possible they may not be in the paper and ink business anymore. But it seems like the editorial function, the peer review function, the imprimatur of the University of California, or the University of Chicago, or the Cambridge University Press, that function, it seems to me, has to persist at least for a time. And it may be that the business model is completely upended, but it seems that it just seems unlikely that all of these things will go away. Although I think you're absolutely right. You know, every university being in the business of printing and binding books and putting them on trucks and shipping them to, you know, parts unknown, it seems like a dead end business.
Mm-hmm. Now, the one thing, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, George Mason exist within one of these research library consortia that was supposed to do what Josh just described. They were going to look at their circulation patterns. They were going to then, you know, start paring down their purchases and have agreements about who was going to buy what, and things would circulate. And so the Washington Research Library Consortium is a great thing. Also, I did, while Josh was describing this, I went and looked up my incredibly obscure first book, and there are 4 copies of it in the consortium, which is absurd. There should be 1. And because, I mean, it's one of those books that the, you know, gets checked out probably once or twice a year at the most. Am I proud of it? Yes. Is it widely used? No. And so why do we have 4 copies in the consortium? It's just crazy.
But there's a lot of interest among librarians in looking at that, finding that kind of redundancy and stamping it out. Sorry for your book. It is, you know, why not have 1
out,
copy,
you know?
Instead of, you know, if there are 12 copies on the Eastern Seaboard, maybe we could make do with 2.
So what does this mean once there's more of an electronic distribution for these monographs? I mean, is that maybe something that's better because then all these libraries will subscribe to Mills's monograph or get a subscription to all of the books from that press? I mean, does that help solve this problem?
I would actually say I think it goes even a bit further in reading some of the tea leaves of, for example, what Google has proposed. I think we're going to start seeing, on one hand, much smaller kind of per person, essentially license fees to get access to a particular book. And at the same time, sort of broad-scale institutional subscriptions that for anyone doing research in the humanities or social sciences or the arts are going to be as important as having, you know, light or power or heat to doing research. I think in some ways the published literature starts to look a little more like almost bedrock infrastructure that scholarship is built on top of. And we stop thinking about, you know, individual books as things that are bought and sold individually.
I was just about to say, I know there's a lot of increasingly people don't want the whole book. They want a chunk of the book. They want the introduction or the third chapter because that's what they're going to use in the classroom or what they need for their particular research project. And I think there's definitely a market for, it's already happening, I guess, that people buying bits and pieces here and there and putting them together into their own course packs or resources. It's an interesting thing for publishers to have to, you know, how does a publisher satisfy that need and how does a library fill it as well?
I think that model of that sort of the metaphor of information or books or however we want to frame it as a utility is a compelling one and interesting to think about, a utility like electricity or a utility like water. And it's interesting to think then what you know, there are certain benefits to having a water utility where you turn on the faucet and you get your water. There are also certain drawbacks in that there, you know, utilities tend to be monopolies. And there are, you know, if anybody's ever had to deal with, you know, Washington Water, for instance, it's not a pleasant experience. So I think Josh, that kind of idea of information or books as infrastructure or utility is an interesting one and something we should probably explore a little more.
You know, this strikes me as really very much what this project coming out of the Internet Archive called Book Server is sort of trying to approach, of this sense of, you know, really what is a book collection. And the Internet Archive has boiled this down to effectively it is a collection, it's a set of metadata that refers to some objects that may be digital or real or physical. Josh, have you been following this Book Server story? We meant to discuss it last time on the podcast. We didn't quite get to it. And it's a little bit technical in that really much of it is a specification for the technology. But what's your take on this Book Server thing that really, as I see it, really enables anyone to become a publisher, which again, feeds into this scary environment for academic publishers?
So, I mean, my read on it is that at one level, what the Internet Archive has said that they're doing and is positioning itself to do is to set up a marketplace, that's not beholden to any one sort of large corporate entity. It'll be beholden to the Internet Archive instead, and which at a fundamental level is a place for publishers of any size, individual all the way up through, you know, the largest mainstream New York publishing houses, to put their books out there and define the terms under which they can be traded, bought, and sold. Now, there's something that I find really intriguing, kind of buried a little bit in the discussions of Bookserver, that in some ways is the most potentially incendiary thing that that Brewster's sort of launched in a while, which is the idea that that maybe the right of first sale, the right that says, hey, if I buy a physical book, I can, you know, after I read it, I can give it to somebody else. It's that very right that underpins, for example, a library's ability to circulate its collections, to let people check out books. Because all of a sudden you may have, you know, 5, 10, 50 people reading one copy of a book that the publisher only got paid for once. I think, you know, there's one model where publishers would like to shift to a sort of per-use license for books. But one of the things that the Internet Archive is proposing is actually bringing that notion of first sale and the idea of lending into the digital realm, where they want to push is to say, hey, if we own a physical copy of a book, or even, you know, if I, Josh Greenberg, own a physical copy of a book, if I want to make that book available to everybody else, they have an infrastructure that would let me make my book available, offer a digital copy of that book, and I could, in essence, lend anyone else that copy of the book, as long as I agreed that I wouldn't use my physical copy at the same time. So you can almost imagine a library where there are shelves full of books, and whenever anyone requests a physical copy, or whenever anyone requests a digital copy of one of those books, that book is in essence put in a locked box until the remote user is done looking at the digital version. Really pushing that idea of lending in a way that actually resonates a lot with a lot of the discussions around the Nook, Barnes & Noble's book reader, which also has been talking about lending in interesting ways.
It's really what's been missing from the e-reader environment is that ability to lend, you know, without restraint, without, you know, the way I could hand you a copy of a paperback and you could mark it up and do whatever and hand it back to me. And if Bookserver can address that in any way, that would really, I could see that really going somewhere.
I'm guessing copyright owners are not going to be pleased with this interpretation of the right of first sale. I don't know. I think probably we're going to hear something from them on this.
No, they're going to be fine with it.
Now, one thing that actually, Tom, that raises is if you think about, say, you know, I did a lot of research on video stores. If you think about a video store as an institution that relies on first sale, or at least the video store back when they were actually vibrant institutions in the early 90s, say, the idea there was you could buy a copy and you could circulate it, but every tape wasn't out every night. And in fact, you would check out a video on a nightly basis, so for a 24-hour period, but you weren't watching it all 24 hours. Now, in the digital environment, if this idea of lending actually manages to translate to digital files, how many copies of a book actually need to be bought if you can construct a system that's hyper-efficient in allocating those copies across, you know, potentially a global audience? How many people are simultaneously reading any book at any given time? That's sort of where that leads, and that suddenly opens up a whole other, you know, can of worms for the publishing industry.
Wow, this is a really scary podcast here for our friends in the publishing industry. You know, on the positive side, I suppose part of what Internet Archive is getting at here is also the sense that in a giant sea of digital books, many of them freely available online, curation is a big deal, right? I mean, the ability, I guess this brings us back full circle to where we started the podcast, that the sense of, let's say, a librarian curating a list, and really Bookserver is just, at its basic level, is like a list, like an RSS feed from a blog. It's merely a list that specifies the location of some books and some metadata about them, including rights about what you're allowed to do. Am I wrong about that, Josh? I mean, that maybe this opens up a market for, you know, just your professor who knows a lot about a particular topic and might want to curate a kind of quote-unquote library off of their own website.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a... anyone who's heard me talk about this stuff in the past year or two knows that I'm pretty obsessed with the notion of professional identity and who does what and division of labor. And I think, you know, these traditional categories of the scholar slash professor, the student, the librarian, the publisher, all of a sudden, a lot of the activities that each was pretty solidly identified with are kind of up in the air. You know, if ultimately curation is what's going to be most valuable, and where both professional identity and frankly, you know, money is going to kind of come from, the more and more that information is seen as a utility, who does that curation? Does it happen at an institutional level, at a university? Does it happen in a professional society? Does it, you know, you can see that playing out any number of ways. And in some ways, I feel like it's almost like a hockey puck that got thrown into the middle of the ice, and there are a bunch of different players skating towards it, and it's not clear who's going to actually seize it yet.
Right, right. Jennifer, when you talk to publishers, I mean, what is their sense of this? I mean, what do they say is their unique talent that means they should exist in the future? And when something like this, a disruptive technology like BookServer comes along that allows really anyone to, quote unquote, be a publisher, what is their response?
Well, there's still a lot of emphasis on the editorial filter, the value that they add through, you know, working with authors on manuscripts, on just the kinds of work that they pick. You know, if you get a, you have some hope that if you get a book from Oxford University Press, it will be of a certain caliber. I mean, that may not, you know, be the case with every book, but there's a certain sense of, okay, well, this has gone through a certain number of gatekeepers. It's passed through the hands of an editor, a copy editor. It's got some kind of, you know, patina of professionalism surrounding it, and that I think is one thing that they say they still can really add, that you can't, you know, there's just so much information out there. You want to know it's coming from a reliable source. It's going to be worth your time to buy this book, read it, download it, give it to your students, whatever you're going to do.
Right. Sure. Well,
if that's enough of a, you know, if that's enough, but that certainly is still very important to them. And I think they believe it sincerely. So.
Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there. We'll call that on a positive note. Right. If publishers out there have listened all the way through, Jennifer Howard of the Chronicle of Higher Ed has given you a positive note to end on. Jennifer, it is great to have you on the podcast. We hope we can have you back on an irregular basis. We really value your editorial filter is incredibly valuable, given what Tom Mills and I naturally do on the podcast.
Right, what passes.
And the best place to find you, let's see, on Twitter, you are Jen Howard, right?
That's right.
And we will link, of course, to your homepage on the Chronicle of Higher Ed, where you can read all the stories that Jennifer's involved in. And you're also a fiction writer, is that right?
I do write some fiction, yep.
That's great. And that's linked to from your blog, which we'll also put a link on our show notes at digitalcampus.tv. Let's see. Thanks for coming on the podcast. It's great to have you on.
Thanks for inviting me. It's been fun.
Sure. And Josh, great to have you back on the podcast as Associate Director of Echo. It's always
pleasure.
Nice.
Thank you so much.
Great to have your expertise in your big new position at NYPL. And not so new. Gosh, you've been there for a while now.
2.5 years, yeah.
That's amazing.
Wow.
It's amazing. You're at Epistemographer on Twitter. Is that
yes.
correct?
I am
okay,
indeed.
Great. And we will link to your page on NYPL. And I know we've talked
Thank
about
you.
Some of your great projects, like the incredible Maps project, which I'm blown away mm-hmm. by. Terrific stuff that Josh, you're doing up there. Great
Thank
to
you
have
so
you
much.
On, and we're looking forward to having you back on. And Tom and Mills, as always, great to talk to you. And we'll talk to everyone in 2 weeks on another episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not.